The Guardian.
Put in charge of Scotland's finances before she turned 30, Kate Forbes is widely tipped as a future leader of the SNP and a future First Minister of her country. I'm Jonathan Friedland, and throughout August, I've been speaking to some of the UK's most prominent political movers and shakers. This week, I talked to the woman who in February was catapulted into one of the top roles in Scottish politics, promoted to finance secretary, and told that in a matter of hours, she would have to deliver a budget. Kate Forbes and I discuss Scotland's handling of the pandemic, Scottish independence, her own faith, and her future. This is Politics Weekly. You are the member for a constituency. I'm not going to attempt the pronunciation. I think I could do it, but I think it would be nicer if you tell us where exactly in your very beautiful constituency you are.
Well, I'm speaking to you from Dingwall, and my constituency is, of course, the beautiful Skye Harbour and Badenoch, which I think must be the second largest in the UK, but it has all the best bits in one.
Now, we want to talk about your, in some ways, you know, astonishing because of its speed, your career. You are now the Cabinet Secretary for Finance in the Scottish Government, and you made your delivered your first budget in that role, age 29, which is obviously quite something, described as an overnight sensation in Scottish politics. Now, with all overnight sensations, obviously, there's been a lot of time leading to that. But you were elected, I think, in 2016. But nevertheless, by any definition, this has happened very fast. What is your own explanation for why it's all moved so quickly for you?
And of course, fast is not always good, too.
But oh, do you think there's a part of it that's not good?
No, I mean, I think, you know, many politicians will say this and it may sound like rhetoric, but I am motivated by a sense of duty. And that means that when opportunities present themselves, and I think if you look back at the budget, that was very much a case of nobody else being able to step up to the mark at that point. So I did it. So I would say it's been less intentional and more just a case of how events have unfolded and being willing to take the next step. But I mean, I started out, I suppose, at a relatively young age. And that brings with it the requirement to fill a role, whether you feel like you fill the role or look the role. And you just have to do the role that people expect you to do. And of course, you learn the cut and thrust of politics in village halls. You learn it during hustings, going for an election, or you learn it dealing with really difficult issues in the aftermath in village halls, which are, you know, full of people dealing with heated issues. And that then carries forward into government roles where perhaps just the village halls are a bit bigger.
And that learning obviously has happened since you've been elected to the Scottish Parliament. But what about before then? I mean, where did you receive your political education, if you like?
I think around the dinner table. So my family are not political with a capital P, but we're political with a small p, in that I don't think we ever had a meal together that didn't have a side of debate and argument. And I think that then obviously I went to studied history at university because I love people's stories. And I grew up abroad as well, which I think informs just a perspective on the world. And that carried through university, went to train as a chartered accountant. And then in 2016, the opportunity came to stand for Parliament. So I guess the three main ingredients was an upbringing of constant argument and debate, a little bit of history and international perspective, and then some financial rigour from my chartered accounting training.
So you mentioned growing up around that, you know, the kitchen table, those conversations, debate there, and being abroad. And I know you spent five formative years, I think, between ages 10 and 15 in India. And I'm interested how that came about and what impact you think that might have had on you and your politics.
Well, I certainly had no choice in the matter because it was my dad's job. So he worked for a charity. He worked for some Christian charities in the healthcare sphere, providing free healthcare. And so we initially went to just the local Indian school. And then after a few years, in order to get internationally recognised qualifications, went to an international school as well. And I think in terms of perspective, everything is relative. So we discuss poverty in this country, and my growing up was very much informed by the visible examples of complete and utter poverty. Visiting slums that would last for miles and no welfare state. So I talk about, you know, one of my most visible memories is doing PE in my local Indian school, which was not a great school. It was just a very local school. It wasn't an international school, but doing PE surrounded by children that were probably younger than me, doing manual labour, helping to build part of the school. And that strikes you hard when you're 10 years old and you've just come from Scotland, where school's a relatively safe place. They, you know, you get a bus to school and then you come back. And if you're sick, you go to the doctors and it's all free. And even as a 10-year-old, that strikes you. Whereas in India, all of that was turned on its head and you get used to seeing tarpaulin shacks housing families. So that for me was the sort of foundations of trying to understand what the differences were between India and Scotland. Some good, some not so good.
One thing that comes up a lot when people talk about you and your future in the SNP and in Scotland is your faith and your membership of the Free Church of Scotland, which has some socially conservative positions, let's put it that way. I'm keen to hear from you about that and about how it informs your moral outlook on the world. I mean, first of all, for people who are new to you, how observant a Christian are you? Do you, for example, work on a Sunday?
During the pandemic, that's probably happened more than most times. I mean, I think that normal, healthy politicians should take some time off. And I try to take Sunday, as much of Sunday as possible, with family and just to reset the clock. But I mean, in terms of the wider issue, you know, I think that you've got to be honest and upfront with the electorate. So my constituency know who I am. I don't hide anything. And then it's up to them whether they vote for me, whether they choose me. We all come at this with our own identities, our own experiences, our own backgrounds. None of us are completely and utterly, you know, single-minded when it comes to politics. And I think people see that. But also, I think that my constituents would vouch for the fact that I represent everybody. If you come looking for my help, I'll help you.
Do you have any trouble squaring your own deeply held positions, which people will respect because they're rooted in faith, with some of the social positions that these your party has on gay rights, on trans rights, same-sex equal marriage, abortion? Is there daylight between your positions personally and the positions of the party? And if so, is that difficult to square them?
I don't think it's difficult to square them, no, because I think on two points. One is that I'm a member of the SNP, knowing full well what their manifesto positions are, and knowing full well some of the changes that they've brought in themselves. And I think, you know, a party like the SNP is broad enough to accommodate debate and discussion. And at the end of the day, when it comes to government, collective responsibility. So we can have all manner of discussion on different issues. But at the end of the day, collective decision making means that I stand by the decisions.
See, this came up a bit when Tim Farron was leading the Liberal Democrats for the UK. And the question made was, that's what you've just said is absolutely right for an individual member, but very difficult for somebody who might even one day be a leader. They can't then talk about collective responsibility or debate in the party. So do you, for example, do you agree with the SNP's position on same-sex marriage in favour of it?
Well, I think, I mean, within the SNP, there's two answers I'd give. One is, within the SNP, there's plenty of forum for debate, right? And even as a leader, there's plenty of forum for debate, but then they come to a conclusion and that conclusion stands. And when it comes to same-sex marriage, that was a decision that was taken a number of years ago. It is the law of the land there's nothing that I'm doing in terms of campaigning on any of those points. You know, that is the position that the SNP has come to. And, you know, I've got plenty of other things to be debating and discussing.
I understand that. So you wouldn't campaign for the policy to change or to overturn it. But could you look Scots in the eye and say, I support it?
I think that when it comes to all of these issues, I'm happy to have a discussion and a debate. But you look at the last 4 years, you look at the hustings I've been on, you look at the interviews I've done, at no point have I stood up and looked Scots in the eyes and said that I fundamentally disagree with the SNP. It's the law of the land right now. My own faith, views that are born of my faith, are also well known. And the thing with the SNP is it's a broad church that allows for debate.
Yeah. I mean, and I think a lot of people would be drawn to that position. I'm just wondering if some would be disappointed you're not able to say, yes, I support it.
At every election, they have a choice when it comes to returning me or not returning me. And there will be plenty of debate and discussion. I stand by the SNP's manifesto. I think in every election, people are both choosing an individual as well as voting for a party. People will vote in different ways for different reasons.
Sure. We'll leave this in a minute. The last bit on this is the, as I understand it, the Free Church and its current interpretation of what's called the Westminster Confession, which is said to include some pretty bruising attitudes towards Roman Catholics. And I wonder if you yourself have ever, for example, attended a funeral or a wedding in a Catholic church, and if that came up, if you were invited, whether you would do that.
One of my closest friends at university is a Catholic and got married, and I was in attendance. Sadly, not as a bridesmaid, but I was in attendance.
And was that in line with the teachings of the Free Church, or were you sort of defying the teachings of the Free Church?
I have grown up going to so many different churches. I have grown up in India, where I think you'd be hard-pressed to find a Free Church. I go to a local church here. I sometimes go to the Church of Scotland. I mean, I go along to a Free Church. I wouldn't say that when it comes to church, my faith is personal. It's a personal belief in God. That is more important to me than any church structures. So, you know, I make my own decisions on the basis of what I believe is right and wrong, according to my faith, not according to the diktat of any church.
And therefore, taking everything you said together, there's no reason why a member of the Free Church could not serve, not hypothetically, not even necessarily about you, but there's no reason why a member of the Free Church could not serve as the leader of the Scottish National Party, or indeed as Scotland's First Minister.
Well, I think that's very dangerous territory to be discussing, because that, if you push that to its logical conclusion, you would be suggesting that any individual on the basis of an Equality Act characteristic was not able to participate in the public square or the public debate, forum. That would include race, religion, ethnicity, sexual orientation. So I would be deeply concerned if it was the case that any party was suggesting that an individual with a protected characteristic could not serve.
And that's part of the inclusiveness that the SNP and, in fact, Scotland would want to hold dear, that anybody, regardless of race or religion, could aspire to any position.
Well, indeed. I mean, that does not mean that any of those individuals only serve people with similar characteristics. That is an absurdity. Any leader will have their own perspectives, their own background, but they are called on to serve every person in society, whether they voted for them or not.
After the break, Kate Forbes and I will discuss the future for the SNP and the prospects for Scottish independence. We'll be right back. Welcome back to Politics Weekly. I'm Jonathan Friedland, and this week I'm speaking with the Cabinet Secretary for Finance in Scotland, Kate Forbes.
Thank you, Presiding Officer. Today I present the Scottish Budget for 2020-21. This is a budget that offers vision and leadership at a crucial moment for our country.
Take us back to that moment when you delivered that budget, and it was in February of this year. You became the first woman to deliver a budget in either Scotland or the UK Parliament. No, there still hasn't been a woman to do that in Westminster after your predecessor, Derek Mackay, was forced to resign. Can you just talk us through what that's like to stand up and do that and what it felt like to you that day?
Well, at 7 a.m., having had no intentions whatsoever to be involved with the budget process that was kicking off at 2:40 p.m., I was asked to deliver it in its entirety. The statement, the questions, know the budget document from start to finish, be ready to give a quick answer on precisely what the new tax rates were and why and whether this budget was going up or this budget was going down. So my only approach was to get into that document and cram for all it was worth between 7 a.m. and 2 p.m. And of course, it's one of the biggest set pieces of the parliamentary calendar. And journalists looking for any hint of nerves, any hint of worry, the opposition are not going to give me any room just because I'm new. And so I was very aware of all of that and realised that whilst, you know, any thought about what was going to happen would give rise to huge nerves, I just had to cram and be ready and prepared. And in a sense, you are, you know, a sole ranger. You're there, you know you're going to be up there on your own, and you've got to be prepared.
Was there any moment where there was some discussion of you not doing it and say, because it was, the circumstances were so exceptional, you know, the First Minister, Nicola Sturgeon, delivering it instead, for example? That would have been an option.
I mean, I'm sure they discussed it and I'm sure they considered it. But all I know is that I got the request to do it. And
from Nicola Sturgeon, presumably.
Well, indeed. Well, it was her chief of staff, but indeed. And I guess at that point you contemplate the fact that this could be your biggest undoing. Because if you're not ready and you stand up to deliver this set piece and you crash and burn spectacularly, that's the last gig you're going to be asked to do. So it's got a high degree of risk and you have further to work your way back from than if you'd just not done it at all. So there is a risk. But I think, again, going back to what prepares you for that, is the cut and thrust of normal politics in village halls, in the most remote areas of my constituency, where you've got to stand up and be ready, whether you feel like it or not. Now, it's a different context. It's a bigger platform. There's more people watching that can write more words. But at the end of the day, it's the same task, which is to get up, give an account of yourself that sounds confident. And of course, I believe that confidence is always manufactured.
It is inevitable, a politician who achieves such a high position so young, that people are going to say there's no reason why they can't go all the way. That has already been said about you, that you're, you know, just inevitably must be talked about as a future leader. Is that something you would want to do?
Not at the moment. And when I say not at the moment, I don't just mean there's somebody there. I mean that it's right now, it's not a proposition that I'm interested in, because I think for two reasons. One is that I'm relatively new to this level of leadership, and I think that you have a lot to learn. I think if you rise too fast without the experience, the skill set, then you're more likely to sink and burn quicker. And secondly, during the pandemic, it's been so clear how challenging, how lonely, how painful leadership is. And so many of the most difficult decisions that Nicola Sturgeon and other leaders have had to take, that frankly, I don't think many of us would have been able to take. So I would honestly say that the pandemic would make me say leadership is a tough gig. And at the moment, I'd rather not.
Okay, that's a good answer. And I think people will have noted the words "at the moment." They're there. They feature prominently. Your counterpart in Westminster is Rishi Sunak. He made a very highly publicised visit to Scotland at the beginning of August. I'm guessing that as part of that, he would have met you and the two of you would have talked. If I'm right, what did you talk about and what did you say to him?
Unfortunately, you're wrong, because he didn't come see me. He went to the Isle of Bute and he met with the new leader of the Scottish Conservatives, rather than discussing the country's response to coronavirus with Scotland's finance minister or even economy minister. He could have had either of us. But we only heard of the visit very, very late on the night before. And I certainly didn't get an invitation.
So you had the same assumption I did, that actually if the Chancellor of the UK is coming to Scotland, he would have at least time for a conversation with the Finance Secretary of Scotland. But he didn't. And you think that's wrong, presumably?
Well, I think that if we are all in this together, which we keep being told we are, and if Scotland has benefited so spectacularly from the broad arms of the Union, then I would think he should have no concerns or worries about speaking to me whilst he's in the country. And I would have been very happy to discuss anything with him. And I think there are particular challenges facing Scotland that would have been good to raise.
In a way, there's some, you would have had quite a lot to talk about. There's some common ground between you in that you both were thrust into the high office, particularly finance ministries, quite suddenly, and just before the country was hit by a huge and global pandemic. I mean, you have made clear that you're not wholly satisfied with how the UK government and Sunak himself has responded in terms of Scotland. And you've been challenging the figures that the UK government puts out in terms of how much money Holyrood actually does receive from the, you know, handouts that Sunak has been trumpeting. How would you characterise your worry about the UK government response to coronavirus?
So I think the first thing I have to say, and I keep saying it, is that during a pandemic, we've got to work together. There are technical issues to do with how we manage the budget in order to ensure that businesses have support, we've got sufficient PPE, the health service can respond, that require us to be collaborative. And I've had a lot of constructive conversations with the UK government's treasury. However, on one sticking point, we still have not made progress. And that is on the flexibilities for Scotland. Now, I am not asking for anything radical or significant or substantial. There's cross-party support for us to be able to have slight flexibilities within our budget to better respond. And at the moment, we are so dependent on the money that comes from Westminster as a result of their policy choices. And if they decide for political reasons that they're going to do things in a way that doesn't generate consequentials, then I have no additional money. And I cannot borrow. And at a time when there is record low interest rates and every country around the world is mobilising its response through borrowing, that feels like I'm responding with one arm tied behind my back. And that's what I've been trying to appeal to the UK government to understand. That on one hand, I will keep asking for additional finance. But on the other hand, to be able to move quickly, this is a pandemic. This is an emergency. These are extraordinary circumstances. And to be able to respond quickly rather than what often happens, which is you get a UK government announcement and a few days later they figure out what that means for Scotland. And I've got those few days in the middle where I'm under pressure from businesses saying, well, what does it mean for Scotland? And I say, well, I need the Treasury to tell me what it means for Scotland. And so you've got that delay and that lag, which creates a problem. So those are the technical issues that could be resolved if there was a willingness to resolve it.
There will be people listening to that and think, look, of course you and Nicola Sturgeon and the rest of the Scottish Cabinet are going to be critical of Westminster's and London, the London government's COVID response, simply because you need there to be that friction and tension between London and Edinburgh in order for there to be more support for independence. So that's just inevitable with the SNP dealing with a UK government. It does take two to tango. Do you think that Scotland itself has dragged its feet in terms of cooperation with Westminster in order for there to be still that argument for independence, which is, look, you know, we would be doing so much better if we could make all the decisions ourselves?
Well, the short answer is no, because of the pandemic. So, you know, I am a politician. I will always make political arguments, but I would encourage everybody to just look at the facts of the pandemic. And that's why I have cross-party support for my financial asks, Lib Dems, Labour, Greens and the SNP all united in our financial asks. Now, we would all have a different view about Scotland's constitutional future, but we're all agreed on those financial asks. Now, if I had gone in asking for the world and then had a grievance, you may have an argument there. I haven't. I've gone in with the bare minimum of what we need to deal with the budget in order to respond. And when even that is declined, it makes you wonder why, because it wouldn't cost the Treasury a penny, but it would require them to shift. And that would require, I think, from the very top, an appreciation that Scotland maybe needs a little bit of additional powers or additional flexibilities. And my view is it's there for a political stance.
You say, as you say, you are a politician. We are in a pre-election year. It's a matter of months away that Scotland goes to the polls again in May of next year. How confident are you about the SNP and its prospects in those Scottish parliamentary elections in 2021? And is it your estimation that you're going to be judged entirely on how you've handled the pandemic? That, you know, there are governments across the world who are facing voters, and it's assumed that it's all about how they've handled this crisis. Is that how you think Scottish voters are going to make their decision come May?
Well, there's still a number of months before May, and usually voters will continue to consider their options right up to polling day. So I do not think that you can assume that what is happening right now will be the primary objective, as it were, for how voters vote. However, I do know my inbox tells a story anecdotally, and the polls all say that the way that Nicola Sturgeon has handled it in terms of her empathy, her honesty, her transparency, and her willingness to own mistakes has convinced people that would otherwise not have given her much credit. And I'm certainly seeing that in a constituency level, and that's what matters, that people that may not agree with our constitutional preference and may not agree with other things the SNP have done, they want a leader during a pandemic like this. And she has stepped up to the plate on a daily basis, doing those press briefings, answering any question. And at the very beginning, she said, we'll make mistakes. And that's true. But on every occasion, she's owned them. And I think that's highly unusual for a politician, and I think it resonates with voters.
Talking of mistakes, there's been a lot of flack for how the Scottish Government handled students' exam results this summer and the way that they had to be regraded after the initial sort of projections from school and so on. Is that a case where the Scottish Government has to put its hands up and say, look, we got that wrong?
There's two answers to that. One is, there's no easy answer when students have not been in school, formal schooling, since March, and have not been able to sit their exams. And exams are usually that anonymous, arm's length decision on students' futures. So if you look at the stats, if I leave it in the just looking at stats, there's no way that the huge increase in the pass mark was credible. However, when it comes to individuals who are determining their future, you can fully and totally understand their anger, their frustration, and their worry because their futures have been changed as a result of the results they get. So I think there has to be a process by which they are recognised for their work. We have got an appeal system that will look at each individual student, that will look at all the evidence they have in terms of the full year and to come to a mark. What I want us to be in a position come mid-September, particularly those going on to university, where they are content with the marks that they have. And the appeals process is a critical element of that. And it's done on a student by student basis.
Now, I mentioned the election. Obviously, the election will be read in Scotland and across the rest of the UK, maybe even the world, as partly, or as it always is, a vote on independence, because that is the driving, animating purpose of the Scottish National Party. What is the strategy for the SNP, which, as I say, is in business in order to make Scotland independent? What is its game plan for how it gets from where it is now to independence? How do you see it playing out?
So the first thing is that whilst we are completely focused on the pandemic just now, there will be an explicit reference to independence in the manifesto. And as we work towards next year's election, I think there's an opportunity for the people of Scotland to make clear that they believe it's currently undemocratic for the UK government to continue to deny Scotland a second referendum when independence is the favoured choice, or at least another referendum is the favoured choice, as polls have shown and as recent elections have shown. And I think right now, the fact that that democratic choice is not being honoured, it's actually convincing more people than if they just gave a referendum. Because you don't have to support independence to realise that if the SNP keeps winning and independence is part and parcel of their objectives, and for Boris Johnson, who did not win in Scotland, to continue to say no, that's undemocratic. You don't need to support independence to realise that it's undemocratic to keep saying no, not least when so much has changed. So my view is it's a matter of time. The next election is key to that. The longer Boris Johnson says no, the more persuaded others will be. And I think that eventually becomes such a wall of support that Scotland will become independent.
Kate Forbes, thanks so much for joining us on Politics Weekly.
Thank you very much.
Next week, as we say goodbye to the summer, we're back to our usual format, so do come back for that. The producer is Danielle Stevens. I'm Jonathan Friedland. Please stay safe and thanks for listening.
For more great podcasts from The Guardian, just go to theguardian.com/podcasts.